Welcome. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Tamika Phillips. I'm a third-year law student here, and I'm a board member for the Center of the Study in Race and Law. On behalf of the center, we are honored to welcome Stephen Black and Professor Dan Nagin to speak on these very important and relevant topics. I just want you all to know to feel free and go back and get food and get seconds and everything, and if you need to leave early, you can exit out that way or through the cafeteria so as not to disturb the speakers, and turn off your cell phones if you haven't already. So we're going to begin our presentation with Stephen Black. Stephen Foster Black is the founder and president of Impact Alabama, a student service initiative, a nationally unique nonprofit that provides students the opportunity to address community needs within structured service projects designed to promote learning and leadership development. These students provide working Alabamians with essential services through the program's three major initiatives: Focus First, Save First, and Speak First. Since its inception in 2004, Impact Alabama has trained thousands of student volunteers from over 20 colleges and universities across the state. In turn, these students have screened over 45,000 children for vision problems through Focus First, prepared tax returns for more than 1,400 working families through Save First, and provided a four-year debate team program for 24 gifted students from Birmingham's public high schools through Speak First. Earlier this year, Black received the prestigious Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Community Health Leaders Award for his work with Focus First. This national award is given annually to individuals who demonstrate creativity and commitment in addressing society's most pressing health issues. This year's 10 recipients were chosen from over 800 nominations. Black, who is the grandson of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, grew up in New Mexico after most of his family left the state in the 1950s and 60s following his grandfather's role in the decision of Brown v. Board of Education. Despite growing up over 1,000 miles away, from a very young age, he was fascinated by Alabama and the legacy of his family's commitment to public service in their home state. In addition to his grandfather's work, his aunt, Virginia Foster Dyer, was one of Montgomery's most famous civil rights advocates. A good friend of Rosa Parks, she helped Bell Parks out of jail after she was arrested for refusing to give up her seat on a Montgomery bus. This legacy, along with long summers spent in Alabama as a teenager, reinforced Black's interest in making a difference in his family's home state. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Pennsylvania, where he graduated magna cum laude, and his Juris Doctorate from Yale Law School in 1997. Following his graduation from law school, he returned to Alabama to work for the prominent law firm of Maynard, Cooper & Gale. After only 3 years with this firm, he was called to public service, first serving for a brief time as assistant to former Governor Don Siegelman, focusing on several policy and economic development projects, and then as a candidate for Alabama State Treasurer in 2002. Despite a hard-fought campaign, he came up just 3% short of victory on Election Day. Encouraged by the enthusiasm of hundreds of students he encountered on the campaign trail and through his work as an adjunct professor in the University of Alabama's Honor Program, he turned his focus to creating an organization that would provide young, talented Alabamians with the opportunity and tools to make a big difference in the state. This organization would become Impact Alabama. In addition to his extensive work as president of Impact, Black directs the Center for Ethics and Social Responsibility at the University of Alabama, where he also serves as a senior lecturer in communicative ethics. He also serves on the boards of the Alabama Civil Justice Foundation, the Alabama Poverty Project, Alabama Arise, and the Alabama Nonprofit Resources Center. Please join me in welcoming Stephen Black. Thank you.
Thank you for that introduction. If it says Alabama, I'll join it. I was really, really flattered to make it a call. And I don't know if you all know, Mika was a national caliber debater who was very helpful to our debate team, which is, as she said, a team for really talented kids in Birmingham. And as many of you know, there's something called the Urban Debate League. This is a little different in Alabama. I didn't really have any interest in having a league set up just for Birmingham for kids to compete against other kids in Birmingham. When there are 19 wealthy suburban schools around the state doing debate, I wanted our kids to compete against those kids. I didn't just want to set up a city league in Birmingham. And that's what we set up. And Tamika was really helpful in coming to coach. And we've had a long streak of really talented kids working very hard and performing at a very high level. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. And I want to mention a little bit about our initiatives, but I want to pretty quickly, maybe I can come back to that, because I want to pretty quickly get into a couple ideas along the topics that you all are here for that I think is more important and I think more interesting than just hearing about my work. And that is, and I want to make sure I am quick enough so we can have as many criticisms as there are from this room. I'm fascinated to hear when people disagree with what I say, why you would agree, why you disagree. Selfishly, that's why this is valuable to me. As I think about this stuff all the time, I'm a really big nerd. And I would love to get your opinions on these ideas because I think, I'll put it to you this way, what I want to talk about briefly is what I believe is the single biggest challenge facing the future of moral progress in the country. That's sort of a corny way to start out, and I think what I'm going to tell you is the biggest challenge, maybe a little surprising and may not be number one on your lists, but I'm going to make a case for it. I believe, more importantly than policy failures or partisanship, the biggest challenge, and when I say us, I mean to encompass the generation of 15, 45, really older than that as well, but on our shoulders, a challenge we'll face as young Americans growing older in this country that literally has never been this way before, that I think is so fundamentally important, especially when it comes to dealing with issues like poverty, is demographically and economically a continuing trend toward disengagement, disassociation, a continuing civic withdrawal, segregation, and I don't mean just racially, a separation along, I think even more importantly and more fundamentally fast-moving and important to deal with is along class lines. Now, we'll put this in two ways. Some of you probably heard of Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, which is, I think, one of the most popular versions of a scholarship over the last 5 and 6 and 7 years, looking back 30 years at an increasing trend towards civic disengagement, civic pullback, associational meeting in lower numbers than we had 20 and 30 years ago. There's a lot of indicators looking at this. Sort of traditional American ways to engage with people unlike yourself, focused on a cause bigger than your own self-interest. Junior League, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. I don't know if you all grew up where they had 4-H's. I think they have 4-H's everywhere, don't they? You all know what 4-H is. 4-H, Lions Club, Kiwanis Club, Rotary Club, bowling leagues, Wednesday night church activities. Everything I just named has precipitously declined in relation to the population in the last 30 years. Now, if I were to ask you, if I were to tell you that fewer mothers right now attend PTA meetings in the late afternoon than they did 30 years ago, and I would suggest to you that the reason that is, in my opinion, is that women right now don't care as much about their kids as they did 30 years ago. Would you agree with that, or would you possibly imagine another reason that could be the case? What would come to your mind first as another possible reason other than that? How about they're working? How about women come pouring into the workforce in the late 60s and early 70s? Unheard of numbers by the millions and then tens of millions to the point we're at now, which is, for the vast majority of American families, all adults in the household who are able-bodied are trying to work as many hours as they possibly can. And it's not to buy a third car and a boat. It's to support a family that many of our grandfathers would have been able to manage alone 2 generations ago, often with just a high school diploma. No longer the case. I haven't said anything fascinatingly new to any of you. But when you couple the amount of time Americans are working, which continues to go up for middle-class Americans, to the second, and I think potentially the most poisonous side of a civic disengagement as it relates to how we thoughtfully deal with poverty, and that is a continuing trend towards suburbanization. What I think is fundamentally the biggest challenge on everyone in this room's shoulders over the next 30 years who care about the future of what I would call an ethical, moral, public citizenry. And I don't mean that to say, and I say this in suburban audiences, I don't mean that to say if anyone should feel guilty for wanting to be in a suburban area. We know why people move to the suburbs. 8 years ago, fascinatingly important marker in our cultural evolution. 8 years ago was the first point in our history that a majority of us now live in the suburbs. And there's some kickback, and some people, you read thoughtful articles and pieces about rejuvenating urban communities and the first circle of suburbs, but it's still a trend, and statistically speaking, we're a suburbanizing nation, and the majority of people in rural areas and urban areas, when they're polled, they'll tell you, I want to move to the frickin' suburbs too, I just can't afford it yet. As soon as I can, that's where my family is going. The reason being, for most families, it's 1, 2, or 3. What would you guess is the number one reason Americans say they suburbanize? Safety's 2. Schools. Schools is 1, safety's 2. Third is kind of a mishmash of aesthetic. People's view, people's thinking of what the American dream looks like. Well, the lawns are prettier. That's the way I pictured it growing up. That's what it means to me to be a successful American family. So here we are, we're suburbanizing family, and I'm telling you, this is the most important topic to consider if you care about addressing poverty in the next 40 years. You think suburbanization, that's the challenge to our generation? In basic terms, you're already working longer hours on average as Americans, and now more and more Americans drive longer and longer. Suburbanization also means, just the mechanics of what it means to be a human being in America, that we're driving longer than ever before. There were articles 15 years ago about how we were about to see the backlash. America's had enough. Look at the Atlanta commute. Americans are going to start refusing to go any further. Some Americans do, but statistically, we're still not there. Americans will choose what they believe to be safer neighborhoods and school systems where the kids look like their kids and they believe the school systems work the best. They'll still drive longer and longer, and that's what we're doing. We're spending, on average, over 2.5 years of our lives behind a wheel of a car, which to me makes my stomach hurt, thinking about laying on your deathbed, thinking about your legacy, your life, all your accomplishments, and you have to factor into that those 2.5 years I spent behind the freaking wheel of a car. The reality of a suburbanized country, which fundamentally brings us to this reason, why this is so important for me, and I want you all to consider this, which is a country of citizens who, for the most part, a larger and larger majority, have less and less time, and the time they do interact with people, it's less and less with people unlike themselves. Fewer and fewer Americans spend time focused on participating toward a cause bigger than their own self-interest. Whether you think of yourself as a Republican or Democrat or Libertarian, wherever you are ideologically, I want you all to consider to agree with me on this. That at the heart of thoughtful public decision making, at the starting point of being in any way ready or capable of dealing with poverty as an issue, as a public policy need, is compassion. And I don't mean just a feel-good greeting card version of compassion. I mean the literal definition. The ability to see through some other human being's eyes. The ability to sense what it's like to live another family's life. To walk in someone else's shoes. In your gut, to have it matter to you in your heart and in your gut, another family in another school system's, their ability to raise their child to that child's God-given potential. If compassion is only intellectual, it doesn't develop very far. It can't just be an intellectual exercise. The increasing pull that we experience through suburbanization and longer work hours and an increasingly competitive world economy that requires more and more earners to be working longer and longer hours is a continuing pull away from bonds of citizenship and personal relationships with people unlike ourselves that make it very hard to thoughtfully be able to deal with the problems we need to deal with. And as a starting point, more and more college-educated Americans don't even know what the freaking problems are. The vast majority of straight-A college students across America have no idea 9 million children don't have health insurance. If you all were a room full of college students, and I told you, now you intellectually know. You walked in the door without knowing that, and now you know 9 million children don't have health insurance. That's not good enough to participate in the solution. If that's all you know about those children, a figure on a chalkboard, it's very hard to use part of your life force, part of your energy, your time, your talent, to be part of that solution if all you know of those families is a statistic written in an article. That's not the way compassion works. There's a human requirement to be connected to other human beings, to feel it emotionally and viscerally and make eye contact and see it and hear it, to be a part of the solution. I tell you fundamentally, I mean, you all tell me if I'm wrong about this. Tell me this isn't the wake-up call to a suburbanized country if it really wants to be thoughtful about thinking of ourselves as ethical human beings. Hurricane Katrina. At the time, I was, just for my own edification, I don't have any inclination to go into the ministry, but at the time I was taking classes at Candler School of Theology in Atlanta, at Emory. I was driving over on Wednesdays. This was 2 weeks after the levees broke. I came into a sociology of religion class. A survey had been handed out by a professor. There was a phone survey, a two-night phone polling survey nationally, the night after and 2 nights after the waters broke. Do you all remember the images down from helicopters outside of the convention center? First hundreds of people and then thousands, and no federal aid in sight, no state aid in sight, no city aid. People holding up signs saying, help, drop water, drop. People passed out, heat exhaustion. The inside facility just exploding and overflowing with people. You all remember those sort of images those first 2 nights? That's what the phone survey was about. And we start going through the survey, and a student pretty acutely noticed the most interesting way to track the answers was the breakdown by race. So we start looking at the answers that way. We get to the next page. Did the images you saw, and it explained the images I just explained to you, did those images anger you? 99% of African Americans. Yes, those images angered me. How could you not be angered by seeing those images? People left completely helpless to fend for themselves. Hungry, thirsty, no public response in sight. Of course I was angered. 56% of white Americans. Did those images sadden you? 99% of African Americans. Of course I was saddened at those images. How could you see that happening to people and not be sad? 58% of white Americans. It's kind of an awkward tension in the room. This African-American student sitting across from me, a PhD religion student, flips the paper, crosses her arms, and to summarize what she said, this is basically what she said. Here we are at a divinity school studying one of the most religiously devout industrialized nations on earth. And you all know that? There's not even a close second. This is by far the most religiously devout nation on earth. She says, and it's a religiously devout nation that has at the basic tenet and core of mainline religions across our nation a requirement and obligation on each of us individually to care about other human beings and to work for their benefit and their behalf. That's the starting point for this country. And you're telling me 46, 45% of white Americans weren't angered or saddened at those images? This is a cold, racist country, she said. There's another awkward moment of silence. And I started thinking, and I thought, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of racist people in America. But I don't think that's that 46% number you're picking up. I think if President Obama were here, I think he would agree with me. I don't think he would tell you that that was what that was. I raised my hand kind of tentatively, and I started explaining what I thought was complicating this issue beyond just a cold, fast, reactionary racism. The professor agreed it needed some more consideration. We do some more research. But we come back the next week. There were focus groups done. There was more polling that week, and it became clear, and some of you may have seen it firsthand through interviews on the television. It turns out, we find out over the next 2 weeks, that for the majority of white, God-fearing, suburban, college-educated Americans who initially had that reaction, the underlying reason was not just a cold, calculated racism, but it was this. And some of you maybe even heard people say this. Look, don't get me wrong. I don't want to see anyone get hurt. I mean, certainly I feel bad if someone dies. But let's be honest. I saw that damn storm rolling through the Gulf of Mexico 6 days earlier. My aunt and uncle made it to Birmingham. My cousins drove to Atlanta. I mean, I feel bad for those people, but why didn't they just get in their cars and drive away? Could have planned a little bit better. Tell me this wasn't a powerful wake-up call for tens of millions of Americans who have no idea that there are millions of Americans working paycheck to paycheck without an automobile. Four times that many million Americans with an automobile, but only enough money to fill a gas tank up once in between pay periods. That analysis, whether to put yourself on that highway for a 7-hour delay to get out of the city, is a little bit different if that fact comes into your awareness. There is a powerful risk of a suburbanized nation that isn't thoughtfully concerned with creating relationships and connections across class and race and gender, and doing more than just meeting up with people unlike yourself in the aisles of stores. There has to be a bigger bond than that of shoppers. Now, the final concept I want to leave you all with, and I don't know in your backgrounds and your country how real this is to you in terms of whether you've seen this happening. What's fascinating to me in terms of the future of a country that wants to be morally obligated. Now, this is a very gung-ho, patriotic, people love proclaiming their faith and their values, and most Americans believe by far this is the best country on earth in every way you could imagine. And I too, I'm proud to be an American. But I tell you, and in particular for young people who are serious about wanting to improve the world, this is a fascinating young generation of Americans we have right now. Through the roof in volunteerism, through the roof in being charitable. But there's a paradox at the center of Americanism and volunteerism right now that I think fundamentally needs to be known by a much greater number of people. And I was sort of saying it before, which is this. I can list out the top 20 most productive industrialized nations. 28 of them. We'd be 1, 2, 3, or 4 in 20 different categories, and we'd all be even more proud than we were when we walked in here to be Americans. The number of billionaires, number of gazillionaires, number of millionaires, women's access to higher education, women's access to management position, number of patents, number of copyrights, productivity in all different ways. What an incredibly wealthy, successful, well-endowed nation. And you couple that with the fact that we're the most religiously devout industrialized nation on earth. You talk about a recipe for a progressive moral society dealing with poverty appropriately, morally. Are you kidding me? You couldn't make this thing up. What a country. But I think it deserves attention to think of maybe one other category in those 28 industrialized nations. In addition to just looking at billionaires and millionaires and the GDP and copyrights, let's look at the infant mortality rate, which is a nice way of saying the number of poor babies the society allows to die each year. We moved 2 places this year. We moved from 26th to 28th. 27 other industrialized nations in the world with a lower infant mortality rate than America. If that's not a moral paradox of generational proportions, I don't know what is. And I tell you, very few college-educated Americans know that statistic. And fewer know families with children without health insurance. Fewer people in power have relationships to families where the parents go to sleep at night praying their child doesn't get sick. Because we do have a universal health care system. We have a system of public emergency rooms that are open all night. You can bring your 8-year-old to when he's got an asthma attack. See a resident who's been awake for 38 hours. Hope the diagnosis is right. And we all, as taxpayers, pay 6 times the cost of what it would have done, what it would have taken if that kid had seen a doctor at age 2. This gets harder and harder for a country to thoughtfully deal with the more segregated we become. And I want to make clear about this. I don't mean just racially segregated. I mean suburbanizing out from the cities of America. You'll see signs, and those of you from the South see them. 20 minutes out of a city, you'll see outside of Birmingham. New homes starting in the low 400s. If that's too much for you, just go 15 minutes further. You'll see another sign. New homes starting in the low 300s. That's still beyond your reach? Just get 20 minutes further. You'll see 200. Beyond you? Get to Alabaster. You know Alabaster. A little further outside of Birmingham. If you're willing to drive an hour and 20 minutes, you'll see another sign that says new homes starting in the low 100s. Segregating ourselves by $30,000 income brackets along the interstates of America. More and more time in a car. Less and less time interacting with anyone unlike ourselves. Huge challenge to being able to deal with poverty thoughtfully. To be able to see through race to deal with poverty properly. There are a lot of other aspects of addressing poverty. That was the main thought I wanted to bring to you all. I would love, after the second presenter, any questions, I'd love to say a couple things about the organization. I do. I'll leave you with this thought. The reason I left the practice of law to start this nonprofit and to take a job at the Center for Ethics at the University is I think service learning and the role higher education can have in re-engaging a country to issues of poverty is so fundamentally important, and I think right on us. We are right here. This is a sea change going on across universities and colleges of America. And I can't think of a time when it's been needed more. The number of 18-year-olds rolling onto the campuses of America who have had no relationship with anyone unlike themselves, but are hungry to be part of a cause bigger than themselves. And it's a university's role, and I put law schools in that category. It's higher education's role to not let it be enough for a generation of Americans to pat themselves on the back for just being charitable. Charity is great, but it's not enough. A justice sensibility is required for an ethical society. That's, if I can say one last thing, I lied. I want to say one last thing. The culture of faith and obligation across the suburbs of America has until very recently added to this decline in a justice sensibility. I do really want to make this point. Do I have 3 more minutes? Can I make this point? It'll be good. Maybe you won't think so, but I think it's fascinating. As we suburbanize as a nation, faith institutions suburbanize as a nation. It probably doesn't shock you all to know that churches close down in city neighborhoods where people move away from. And where do they spring up? Where people move to. There's a lot of new church construction in the suburbs, and I mean that non-denominationally. Synagogues, churches, mosques, they're rational actors. They follow the people. Does it shock you all to know that whether you're talking about a small congregation, a medium one, or a large one, that the new structure is usually bigger than the one left behind? Does that surprise you? It doesn't surprise me. I think it would be weird to build a new, have a grand opening and be like, it's going to be a tight fit. It's smaller, but I mean, it's natural. You want to sort of celebrate a new birth, new, fine, right? Nothing wrong with that. But you got a new mortgage. You think to yourself, well, we can count on our traditional neighborhood base of support. No, you can't. You're in the freaking suburbs now. There is no tradition in the suburbs. That's the definition of a suburb. It was a field 20 years ago. And we know denominationally, other than Catholics in the Jewish community, we are all up for grabs, statistically speaking. We've never been so denominationally mobile. What faith are you? Well, I mean, I'm a Baptist. My wife's a Methodist. She loves that women's group they have on Tuesday night. My kids love that Church of Christ with that 24-hour gymnasium. Get back to us next month. We're still trying to figure out what fits our needs the best. And faith leaders will tell you, it's a battleground out there. This is hard to get members in here. I mean, that's why we got that Starbucks bar open. That's why there's new design where the lights go off the wall and give you kind of a warm walnut glow. Looks like a Starbucks. That's why we have the new service in the afternoon for kids. And the carpets are more warm colors, kind of a casino feel to get people feeling soothed and warm. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But what if the new competitive terrain of suburban faith communities across the nation has led to a softening of the definition of obligation? Then I think this becomes another fundamental challenge for our generation. And that's what's happened. When I started reading some statistics and stories anecdotally, I get goosebumps by this stuff. The softening of the language of what's required of you. What's required of you to be a good person? What do you owe other human beings? Let's put it into meat and potatoes. What does it really mean? A rich history through the faith congregations of America of justice as well as charity. Black Church never left the language of justice. Methodist Church has historically always spoken powerfully about universal health care, and Catholic Church has always spoken a lot about economic justice issues, even to specific tax code policies. And now we've seen across denominations, there's always beautiful exceptions, but across denominations, statistically, the language of obligation has now almost become 100% charity. In other words, can anyone raise their hands to bring clothes for that woman's shelter on Tuesday night? People raise their hand. Why aren't we all being good Christians? That's what we need to do. We've met our obligation. Can anyone agree to bring turkeys for that black church downtown that we're partnering with on Thanksgiving? People raise their hand. I mean, we are good people out here. And I may not want to talk about being in a school system in my church where every child has a teacher that has 3 years of chemistry background, and there's a school system 20 minutes from here that has computers from the Gates Foundation, but they don't have the circuitry in the walls to plug the things in, because that may make you feel guilty, and that may lose you to the Church of Christ around the corner. So let's just talk about obligation in terms of charity. We can all be home by 3 p.m. feeling good about ourselves and go on with our lives. The problem with that is it's not enough. Now, this literally is the last thing I'm going to say. 1 minute. And I mean it. You cut me off, Tamika. This has been changing the last 2 years, and one of the most fascinating movements in American obligation definition that we've ever seen. The religious right. The huge, giant force that registered tens of millions of voters in the 80s and early 90s. The Christian coalition has dissolved and divided in half. Fascinating change. The purpose-driven life, Rick Warren. You know that guy? You all heard of him? Mega church, criticized a lot for this sort of suburbanizing, mega church, feel-good thing. 14,000 people congregation. He and his wife go to Africa a couple years ago, come back, stand in front of the congregation. We have made a mistake. The scope with which we've defined obligation has been way too limited. From this day forward, you will hear us, and this congregation will have a voice, and will spend money, and will put effort into the health and well-being of children, not just in our own little neighborhood, but in cities and towns across this country, and yes, in other continents. And we will also have a role in changing the policy to save this earth. And as sure as he started saying that, people walked up, got out of the back of the congregation, and walked out, said, "That's not for me." And before he could finish his sentence, other people walked in the other store and said, "That's what I need." Christian Coalition, same thing. Someone raises their hand 3 years ago and says, "Okay, I'm with you. I agree that gay marriage is immoral. I think abortion should be outlawed. But today I would like to talk about ensuring children's health." Why isn't that a moral issue? This is a coalition of Christians, isn't it? And before that person could finish their sentence, someone else in the other side of the room is like, "Are you kidding me? This is a Christian coalition. We're not taking on children's issues." And this other person is like, "Are you kidding me? Irreconcilable difference. Do you all know this? That organization is divided down the half last year. It's completely divided." Fascinating. And good for the country. Obligation should be messy to define. The challenge of what it means to be in the country right now with 9 million children without health insurance, which will drop some with the growth of the Children's Health Insurance Program, but I think still at unethically high levels. Let me leave it at that. We can maybe talk a little bit after the next presentation. Thank you all for that.
Thank you, Stephen. I'm having disturbing flashbacks of Birmingham suburbs. Thanks for that. Dan Nagin is our next presenter. Daniel Nagin joined the law school in 2006 to direct the Family Resource Clinic, a joint project with Charlottesville's Legal Aid Justice Center. In addition to his work in the clinic, he teaches a course on poverty law. His work and practice experience is focused primarily on housing, family, and public benefits matters. Nagin was previously lecturer and law and administrative director of the Civil Justice Clinic at Washington University in St. Louis. In the Civil Justice Clinic, he trained and supervised law students in the representation of low-income clients across a number of practice areas. Before joining Washington University's clinical program, he spent 2 years at a New York City nonprofit organization as director of a social services and advocacy program for homeless persons living with or at risk of HIV and AIDS. He has also practiced law with legal services programs in the Jamaica section of Queens, New York, and in Indianapolis, Indiana, where he was first staff attorney and then acting co-director of a homeless advocacy project. Nagin graduated from the University of Chicago Law School with honors and received the Edwin F. Mandel Award for his contributions to the clinical program. He received his bachelor's degree from Cornell University, graduating Phi Beta Kappa and with distinction in all subjects. He holds a master's degree in education from Stanford University. Welcome, Dan Nagin.
Technology that works, so give me 1 second. We do not, which is quite likely. I think that there are going to be some interesting parallels in the topic that we're going to address. And we did not speak, nor have we met before, but I'm hoping that that you here will be able to see the links, I think, in the topics, though they're disparate in many ways. So my topic today is really unintended consequences. And I know this is not the center for the study of unintended consequences, but I think it fits nicely into the theme of today. In particular, what I'm going to talk about is how the current economic crisis may indirectly and unexpectedly weaken the long-standing connection between race and poverty in this country. Now, please note, I didn't say break the connection between race and poverty. I said weaken, and indeed, perhaps very modestly so. For, as you well know, race and poverty have historically served as mutually reinforcing categories, and that is not likely to change in substantial ways in the immediate future. But I'd like to discuss some trends that, though they may be largely hidden from view, they may be exerting an important influence just beneath the surface on our culture and our policies. So let me tell you what my thesis is, if you will, and I offer it quite tentatively. It's an idea, really. I want to suggest to you today that the pains working class and middle class white folks are experiencing in the current recession, and perhaps equally importantly, the ways that suffering is depicted in the media are helping indirectly to weaken deeply held assumptions about black poverty. That is, the more white people suffer and are depicted as suffering in this recession, the more likely that entrenched white attitudes about the black poor, that the black poor are lazy and undeserving of governmental help, will weaken. In turn, as attitudes about the black poor modulate, perhaps, it may become more likely that social welfare policies will do a better job of addressing the needs of poor people generally, but also including poor black people. Now, to be clear, I'm not suggesting at all that I want anyone to suffer. White, black, Latino, Asian Americans, Native Americans. I don't want anyone to suffer. But while we're suffering, let's have some good come out of this. It's unintended, really. That's the point. So in making this claim about unintended consequences of the recession, I'm going to build upon and use as a jumping-off point the work of historians and political scientists and other scholars, including Michael Katz and Martin Gillens. These scholars published studies and books, mostly in the 80s and 90s, about race and social welfare policy. And their primary idea was this, that when we think about poor people, and we think about poverty, we tell ourselves a story about why people are poor. And depending on the circumstances, sometimes we tell ourselves that a poor person is poor or a group of people are poor because of personal failures, character weaknesses. At other times, we think that poverty is caused by larger external and structural barriers that are not the fault of an individual poor person or a group of poor people. So these two possibilities, quite obviously, have great importance for social welfare policy. For when a critical mass of the public believes that poverty, and particularly poverty within a discrete community, is the result of personal failure, it is very unlikely that government will enact aggressive social welfare programs in an effort to ameliorate the suffering associated with that poverty. By contrast, when a critical mass of the public believes that poverty is the result of a systemic defect in the economy, or even a natural disaster, of the truly natural kind, it becomes more likely that government will respond meaningfully to the suffering associated with the poverty. So the distinction can be summed up in what may be a familiar phrase to many of you, which is the deserving poor versus the undeserving. The deserving poor get help, the undeserving don't. So it turns out, not surprisingly, that race plays a big role in determining which assumption, poverty as personal failure or poverty as structural problem, a person might deploy when they have to explain to themselves or others why poverty exists in a given circumstance. So race plays a big role in that equation because of complex and deeply rooted historical, cultural forces reaching back to the era of slavery and Jim Crow and Let's just sum that up. That means racial prejudice plays a big role in our legacy of racial prejudice. But according to Gillens and other scholars, these assumptions have also been nourished over the last 30 or 40 years by media outlets and news sources. These sources feed us information and images that help shape the narrative we tell ourselves, our children, our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, to explain why someone is poor. And then these information and images we receive over time, they contain powerful messages about race and the role it plays in poverty. So I've described this earlier work in very broad strokes, but I hope you get the gist of it. And now let's fast forward to 2009. We're currently experiencing an economic crisis of unprecedented magnitude. It's unlike any since the Great Depression, about 80 years ago. So what that means is that for the vast majority of Americans living today, the current crisis is the worst economic crisis they've ever experienced. And the situation isn't pretty. Rising unemployment, epidemic of foreclosures, whole communities wiped out. It is quite profound. The one thing we can say about this crisis is that it's an equal opportunity crisis, right? White, black, Hispanic, very poor, poor, middle class, working class, upper middle class, upper class, all are affected, obviously in different ways, different intensities, but very few people are completely immune. And so this distinguishes the current crisis from other kinds of economic slowdowns and downturns that most Americans have ever lived through. For the current impacts are felt more widely and more profoundly than most people have ever experienced. So what that means is that for many people, it has become just a bit harder, I think, to assume that a person in poverty is poor because personal failures, character weaknesses. For our beliefs about poverty are the product of a set of assumptions and instincts, but they're also the product of personal and lived experience. I've talked about the media, I've talked about personal experiences. Let me just give a quick example here. Quickly look at that picture. Quickly. Okay? Don't read the caption, though. Don't get rid of the caption. This is a photograph from a 2009 Washington Post news article, front section, about the recession in South Carolina and how it's affecting people. And it told the story of various people who had lost their jobs and were seeking government aid or charity of some kind. And for many of those people, the story went on. It was the first time in their lives they had had to reach out for aid in that kind of way. And the picture depicts a woman applying for food stamps and someone looking over her food stamp application. So the interesting question is, and I'm curious, the moment it flashed up, we don't have clickers, I'm not going to ask anyone to answer the question anonymously or by name, is which is the applicant and which is the woman taking the application? Turns out that the woman behind the desk, and it makes it sort of obvious, but it's a little hard to see the computer and who's on which side of the desk at first glance, is that the woman holding the application works for a human services agency, and this woman, the white woman, is the applicant. 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, I think it would have been very, very unusual to see a photograph such as this depicting someone reaching out for government aid. And the fact that the white applicant is handing the application in to an African-American employee makes the photograph, I think, even more striking. So now, let me show you another photograph. This is Time Magazine, 1977. All the faces are people of color. And the title is The Underclass. Obviously a minority within a minority, but it's not the black underclass, it's the underclass. And so I think this was much more common in terms of national media, local media, of the way depictions of poverty were seen in media. But I'll go even a step farther. It's not just poverty, it's also welfare. The first sentence of the article was a quote from a woman named Cherry, who lived in a major American city and is identified simply as a welfare mother of six. So traditionally, when you see images or read about poverty and welfare, the image that you were presented with, the image that came to mind, in sort of a mutually reinforcing way, it was a black face. So the question becomes, in my view, what does the changing face of poverty in the current economic crisis, what possibilities are there for this system of images and representation and codes to be destabilized? And that's what I want to talk about. Now, I haven't done an empirical study of media over the last, 6 or 9 months since the crisis began. Gillens did a study of several decades ending in the 1990s of media images of poverty and race and welfare. But I regularly keep an eye out for media coverage of poverty and welfare because of the courses I teach, because where appropriate, I like to incorporate in current stories and media coverage. And, I detect something has changed in the way the media is covering poverty and welfare. I think it's worth examining these kinds of changes. At the conclusion of my remarks, and I'm going to walk through some other topics and issues that I think are intertwined here, you can decide for yourself if this trend is actual, it's worth considering, and whether the effects I'm suggesting that might be occurring as a result are indeed plausible. So that's my whole talk, essentially. That's my thesis. That's what I'm going to argue to you. And now we're going to walk through it a little bit because there are some twists and turns in the story. And I want to talk about the history of social welfare policy and black poverty. Before I get down to business, though, let me just make a few disclaimers. There are serious debates about whether social welfare programs like TANF and food stamps help people or hurt people. I'm not going to engage that debate. That's not the purpose of my talk, because I'm really focusing on the expressive function of welfare and social welfare policies, because they tell us a lot about our societal commitment to government's role potentially in helping the poor. Second, I want to be clear. I consider race a social construct. I'll use the term black and white and Latino during my talk, but I don't think they have some fixed or scientific meaning. They're malleable categories, so I'm going to use that term or those terms in that kind of way. The next disclaimer, it's my third disclaimer if you're keeping track, there's also a binding arbitration clause in my talk, is that I'm mostly going to talk about welfare and poverty policy in a binary sense, whites or blacks. Indeed, whites versus blacks, if you will. And I realize that the world is a lot more complex than that. African Americans are not even the largest minority population in the country. And I think too often people talk about race in this country as a white and black issue, and clearly it is not. But I think here it's actually somewhat justified, justified enough for me to make it, to present my argument this way, which is the history of social welfare policy really is a binary history in many respects of white and black policy differences, perceptions, codes, perceived differences. So I think it's justified here. Okay. That's all for the disclaimers. There's a waiver going around. Just add your name. Okay. Let's also just define our terms. When I say poor person or poverty, what do I mean? What definition am I using? I'm going to use the federal poverty level. It's completely inadequate. It doesn't accurately measure poverty, according to most everybody. Doesn't factor in cost of living, regional differences, the cost of childcare, transportation. Doesn't consider subsidies, non-cash subsidies that some people might receive. I can go on and on. It's a pretty poor standard or measuring stick. But we're going to use it because it allows us to make some historical comparisons because we have consistent data over the course of time. What do I mean by welfare? This is actually an interesting question in its own right. What do I mean by welfare? What do you mean when you say welfare? Or you hear someone says welfare. What does that mean? Which programs is someone referring to? Because my talk really focuses on commonly held beliefs and perceptions, I'm going to use the term as I think it's typically used by people. And that is as a non-insurance-based, means-tested program to help poor people. And so non-insurance-based safety net programs are programs in which people don't pay into a system and then get their money out in a time of need if they can show that they're eligible. So these are programs that are really fall under the umbrella of a handout, if you will. By contrast, an insurance-based program like unemployment insurance or Social Security disability insurance, those are programs that people pay into through working, and then they can potentially get some of their money back, if you will, if they become disabled or they lose their job for a good reason. So I'm going to focus on this non-insurance-based means-tested program, and that would include AFDC, which was later renamed TANF, food stamps, which has now been renamed SNAP. I'm going to focus on those two core programs, okay? So when I say welfare, I mean those two programs primarily, but also a mix of state and local programs, sometimes called general relief or public aid, that also are structured the same exact way. Okay, let's turn to substance. Let's just take a current snapshot view of poverty and race in this country. Whites, and this is non-Hispanic whites, make up 65% of the general population, African Americans 13%, and Hispanics 15%. So you can see also that there's considerable variation in the poverty rate. You don't have it on the chart, but the national general population poverty rate is a little under 13%. That data is from 2007, which is the last available data from the Census Bureau. It's pretty obviously, I think, going to go up dramatically. So 12.8 is the national poverty rate. And you can see that whites are poor less often than their than the national average, and African Americans and Hispanics much higher than the national average. Let's turn to actually the last set of bars there, which is the percent of the poverty population. And I think that's actually where a lot of the action is, if you will, a lot of the substance of my talk, which is that whites make up a plurality of all poor people in the country, 43%. You know, almost one out of every two poor person or poor people are white. And about one of every four poor people is black. And Hispanics reflect about the same percentage of the poverty population as African Americans. So it is certainly true that the black poverty rate is disproportionately high compared to the percentage of the population that is black. But by no stretch of the imagination are most poor people black. Whites are by far the largest group of poor people. We're going to later look at something that's usually called welfare recipients rates, the rate that groups or individuals use welfare. We'll talk about that in a little bit later, because that actually goes to the assumptions that we make about who's actually on welfare and also why. So let's talk about those assumptions now. Let's talk about assumptions about poverty, about race, and welfare. The story really begins a long time ago, in the 18th and 19th centuries, if not earlier. I won't walk you through that whole history. I'll focus on public opinion polls. But Gillens and others have documented that there's a quite durable belief in some parts of the white population that black people are lazy, that they lack a proper work ethic. And these views, I think, it is without doubt, have existed and continue to exist to justify and explain mistreatment of African Americans during the era of slavery and after. Black folks were perversely stereotyped as not hardworking. Now, these beliefs, these stereotypes, also help explain the assumptions we make about why people are poor. According to a survey from the 1990s, Americans, and this is all Americans, on average say that half of poor people are black. That's just wrong. When the question is rephrased and people are asked whether more poor people are black or more poor people are white, a majority of Americans say that more poor people, that there are more black, that is numerically more poor people who are black than white. Now, none of these is true, not even by a long shot, but that's what people believe. So when you combine beliefs about the work ethic of blacks and the poverty rate, unsurprisingly, you get some very interesting assumptions about welfare recipiency. The general population has historically overstated the percentage of welfare recipients who are black. And so put together, all of these forces help drive welfare policy, really. It's not so much what works and doesn't work, it's what people think that really matters. So let me give you a short history of welfare policy to 2009 so we can bring us back to the current crisis and the ideas that I want to leave you with. I'm not going to start in the 19th century. I'll start in the 20th century. I hope that's okay. Let's talk about widows' pensions. Widows' pensions were a program, a creature of the Progressive Era in the early 20th century, and it was really the first, if you will, welfare movement for there to be some sort of systematic form of government or quasi-governmental aid to low-income families. These were all state programs. And they really grew out of a Progressive Era concern about delinquency problems that and criminal elements, people not following the right path in life. And the idea was, if you had single moms with kids, that if you made sure mom stayed home to take care of the kids, that the kids would end up with better outcomes. And so moms would get, if they qualified, and that was a big if, a modest cash assistance grant from these pension programs, if you will. They hadn't paid in. It wasn't an insurance system, but they were called pensions. But they'd also be regulated for moral conduct and to ensure that their behavior was upstanding. So you really had to prove that you were fit to get assistance. And only those who could be trusted to put the money they received to good use would be approved. And there was incredible discretion at the local level in deciding who would get what benefits. The first state to create such a program was Illinois in 1911. By 1935, all states but two had a similar program. Most of the recipients were urban, not rural, which is makes sense because the progressive movement was really an urban phenomenon. By 1931, 82% of the recipients were widows, 96% were white, only 3% were black. Really, when you got down to it, the widows' pensions, which were sometimes called ADC, Aid to Dependent Children, it was really a welfare program for elites. All right? You had to be upstanding and morally fit, and you had to be white. Sometimes the recipients were even called GILT, G-I-L-T, edged widows. Fast forward to the 1930s. As part of the federal government's response to the Depression, ADC became nationalized. And what that meant was that... come on in, James. Very distracting to have you stand up there like that. What that meant was that ADC, which was a previously a local state-based program, now became a combined federal-state cooperative program. The federal government provided lots of money, a few standards, not many, but then the administration occurred at the state level. Let me offer you a few more thoughts about how these widows' pensions at the state and local level then kind of morphed into a program under the Social Security Act that became later AFDC. A few more thoughts about it. There were no fixed standards of need. Each state could decide who qualified financially and what the amount of benefits would be. There was no work requirement. Indeed, that would kind of defeat the original logic of the program, which was to keep women at home, taking care of the kids so the kids didn't run out and get into trouble, if you will. But even though the woman got to stay home, there was very close monitoring of her behavior. And then critically, 4 years after ADC became nationalized, there was a change made to the program. Widows whose husbands had, now deceased, who had significant work history, were moved into a different category of assistance. They would now get their benefits, their widow's benefits, not under AFDC, but under Social Security. And what that meant is that the only women, and this was primarily and exclusively women, really, at the time, is that the only women left to be eligible for AFDC were the losers, if you will. The woman who hadn't married well or successfully. The woman who had kids but wasn't attached to a man, or who had kids and whose husband had died but hadn't worked enough or long enough. So really what it did is it introduced a real stigma into welfare that really hadn't been there before. Or if it had been there, it really wasn't as pronounced. And so AADC starts to really become the welfare that you and I might think of as a truly stigmatized program. By 1961, the program had expanded so two-parent families could receive benefits under certain circumstances, and it was renamed. They added the F because it sounds a lot better to say AFDC. So I'm going to say AFDC from the rest of the way out until we learn that the program name changes again. So what happens next? Blacks were mostly excluded from AFDC because, remember, this is a locally administered program, and so there's lots of discretion, few federal standards, and there's lots of room for prejudice, discrimination, as eligibility is determined. But federal policymakers urged the states to open up the doors of the welfare office to all. Civil rights advocates increasingly pressed for changes in eligibility. Lawyers start to bring lawsuits to challenge the way welfare is administered. The civil rights movement begins to develop further momentum. And there's a real confrontation, if you will, between those trying to break down the welfare, the doors to the welfare office, and those who are guarding it. In a 1965 book, a seminal book by Winifred Bell, she documents the ways, particularly in the South, that Southern states resist these efforts. Her work was even cited in the first case to reach the Supreme Court on AFDC, King v. Smith, which I think is an Alabama case, if I'm not mistaken, 1968. And Bell and others showed that blacks had been systematically excluded from AFDC. But as blacks moved to the North and advocates in the South began to press for change, Southern states began to use new policies, facially neutral policies, to change eligibility. I'll give you one quick example. Louisiana, 1960. 66% of the children in Louisiana receiving AFDC were African American at the time. So a lot of progress had already been made by 1960 in terms of equal opportunity and access to AFDC. No matter what you think of the program, at least people are receiving benefits if they wanted to apply. But in a single month that year, July, Louisiana cut 22,000 kids off the program, which was about 25% of all kids on the program. So imagine if a state just cut off in a single month a quarter of their entire welfare population. That's what Louisiana did because they changed a rule about which homes were suitable. Okay? Of those 22,000 kids who lost their benefits, okay, about 95% were black. Okay, and this was clearly using a facially neutral rule to deny access to the program to African Americans amid the cauldron of the civil rights movement and pressure from the federal government and others. Ultimately, those trying to force open the doors were able to sort of win the day in some measure, and the program became more accessible. And as a result, however, a real transition occurred. For decades, the percentage of AFDC recipients who were black was disproportionately low when you look at the percentage of poor people who were African American. African American poverty was also already quite high because of Jim Crow and economic discrimination across the board. But now you start to get more and more AFDC recipients who are African American. So let me go to our next slide. This shows the percentage of AFDC recipients nationally who are African American. As you can see from the program's inception as a national program in 1935, it's quite low. But by the late 60s and early 70s, it gets quite high. However, it never reaches 50%. Okay? In fact, it starts to go down afterwards. So, coupled with the intensity of the civil rights movement, violence, uprisings in inner cities, or so-called ghetto riots, LBJ's war on poverty, a wave of white flight from suburbs, the new accessibility of the AFDC program brought black poverty into view in a way that it had never been before, and it also, for the first time, really connected black poverty to welfare policy. Okay? Black poverty had really received little official or media or governmental attention before the 1960s. But all of this was now changing. So at some point, and I can't tell you a day, there was sort of a critical juncture that was reached where welfare became synonymous with black. Welfare became a black face. Okay? And this was not a good thing for the AFDC program. The program was already stigmatized as a program for the undeserving poor from its inception, and now it was doubly stigmatized within our larger culture. For the most part, whites didn't want their tax dollars to be spent on undeserving poor people, let alone undeserving poor black people. So AFDC became increasingly controversial. And benefit levels were very low. Standards were tough. It wasn't a program that was really designed to get you out of poverty. It was a program that you really had to stoop down to receive. In fact, studies show that the greater percentage of a state's population that was black, the lower that state's benefit levels would be. There's a real correlation there. Okay, so now let's talk about attitudes again. Let's bring us back to our original ideas about assumptions and attitudes. This survey data, courtesy of Gillens, that tells us that assumptions about who is poor and who's receiving welfare make huge differences in a person's willingness to support or oppose welfare programs. Okay? And to sum it up, the blacker one thinks AFDC is, the more likely one is to believe that welfare recipients lack a work ethic and that government assistance is unwarranted. By contrast, the wider one assumes, that is the whiter one assumes the AFDC program is, the more evenly split folks are about whether personal failure is the explanation for poverty and whether there's a true need for welfare. Let's talk about the media again, because Gillens really does a great job, I think, an interesting job of documenting this. This is a study of news magazine depictions of poverty over many decades. And this line here represents the actual percentage of the black poor, or of the poor population, which is black. And those peaks, obviously, is the rate at which blacks were depicted in major news magazines of their poverty, when in stories about poverty. In some years, over 70% of the depictions of poor people were of black poor people, and the actual black poverty rate was much closer to 25 to 30%. Now, independent, or I shouldn't say independent, but related to all of this, is that welfare simultaneously became a very useful political tool. No matter the context, as I said, most people don't want their tax dollars to go to help poor people in a non-insurance-based means-tested program. Okay? Welfare programs don't attract a lot of loud champions. They don't have powerful constituencies. Politicians very skillfully realized the utility of talking about welfare, because you could talk about black people without talking about them. You just had to say welfare or food stamps. And so it was in 1976 when Ronald Reagan, at a speech in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, railed against the food stamp program and said how frustrating it would be for people who work to see a strapping young buck. That was his term. Which has, I think, a particular meaning in certain regions of the country, a strapping young buck who uses food stamps to buy steaks. No one needed to say black. All you have to do is say food stamps or welfare during this era, and it has a particular meaning. Okay, so it was useful because you didn't have to be that explicit if you wanted to run on that issue or to raise that issue. Now, AFDC became increasingly controversial as time went on. And everything sort of reached a breaking point in 1996. Conservatives argued that AFDC was a drug. Remember, it's open-ended. It's an entitlement. You can keep getting it forever if you're eligible. You don't have to work. But it was a drug that sapped people of their ambition, their drive to succeed, their willingness to work. Liberals couldn't really defend the program really well because the program didn't lift people out of poverty. And their efforts over the years to attach more services to help people get jobs and move off welfare never really went very far. And then Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992 on a platform, among other things, of ending welfare as we knew it, or as he knew it. And there were a lot of squabbling during his first term, but he was up for re-election in 1996. And he needed to show the public something. And he ended up signing a welfare reform bill that was authored by the Republicans, changing the program's name to TANF. Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. The new version of welfare now has time limits, 5 years or 2 years, a work requirement. Okay, remember, originally the program was to keep women in the home. Now the program is to get them out of the home and into the workforce. No longer would welfare be open-ended. In fact, the undeserving poor were now being weeded out of the program. Meanwhile, liberals were able to get some more job supports and other support services attached to the bill, and so they hoped that that would at least help people who were going to run out their clocks on welfare. Similar but less drastic changes were made to food stamps. Okay, and bear with me. I have about 5 more minutes, and then I will stop talking to you. So what happened? Congress, the president, completely revamped this program that had really run without much change since 1935 in a particular way. Liberals predicted that the world would come crashing down, that child poverty would skyrocket, children would be sleeping on the grates on the sidewalks of cities. Conservatives said that with this push out the door, that people would finally get jobs and feel good about themselves and maximize their potential. And over the 10 years that have followed, we've seen what happened. And the answer is, well, what happened? It's sort of a toss-up. The TANF rolls, that is the number of people getting welfare, has gone down incredibly. It's really remarkable. Poverty didn't skyrocket, so maybe the conservatives were right. But nor did it decrease. It stayed about the same. Many fewer people are on TANF, but about the same number of poor families exist in the country at the same rates.